Welcome, friends, to the Politics Hour with Katie and Anatol. I'm Katie.
And I'm Anatol.
So we've got a packed show for you today. We're going to go through some updates on some old stories we've done and look at some new stuff, too.
Yeah, so in the previous show, we were talking about the federal NDP leadership race, and one of the candidates brought up the topic of minimum guaranteed income, or MINCOM. So we're going to do a bit of an examination of MINCOM today.
Yeah, so for those of you who don't know what guaranteed minimum income is, basically the proposal is that it is a guaranteed minimum income delivered periodically, so it's not all in one grant, it's like monthly or biweekly or however a specific program would hypothetically work. And it is granted in cash or an appropriate medium which allows the recipients to choose what they spend it on as opposed to things like food grants or payment in kind with goods and services. It is paid out on an individual basis, so not grouped by family. And it is universal and unconditional, so there's no test of means. So everyone gets it no matter how much you're already making. And there is no, it's paid out no matter what, so you don't have to prove intent to work or anything like that. Like, it's just money that you get because you are alive and people need money to live.
Right. So this is sort of in response to people who work full-time on a minimum wage job still do not, they still would not make it to the poverty line. So by supplementing income like this to everyone, that ensures that at least everyone can make ends meet.
Yeah, and Dave, a lot of you probably know, because we are from Manitoba, that in the 70s there was a MINCOM experiment done. It was done in Dauphin as well as in select Winnipeg households and rural households. So basically, they brought people up to the poverty line, from my understanding. The research data, there was never really a final report written by the researchers. So we don't know what they think that they conclusively proved through this experiment. But what it shows was that healthcare, people being able to afford healthcare and like being able to live comfortably, people being able to survive was more successful. I don't know if that makes any sense.
Yeah, I heard recently on CBC there was someone has done a reanalysis of the data, and what they found was that the burden on the healthcare system was greatly diminished, and that although it didn't really affect people's propensity to be employed, which is a good thing, it did decrease employment among pregnant women and late adolescent men. So obviously, in the case of pregnant women, that's a good thing. They have time to, you know, take off work and look after their child and make sure that they have a healthy child. And the counterintuitive thing about the young men is that they were actually staying in school longer and not dropping out in order to go work.
Yeah, and I mean, that's not really something you can do anymore. You can't really drop out of school to get a job anymore as easily. Because I think even like minimum wage jobs, if you've graduated, I know I had to provide proof of high school graduation when I started work at the call center. Which is a very interesting employment policy.
Yeah, I do think that there are still some employers that will employ high school kids, like McDonald's.
Oh, well, yeah, no, if you're in high school, it's fine. But once you're at the age where you should have graduated, if you can't provide a high school diploma or, like, the fact that you're in university, then they will, like, terminate you. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah, and I mean, I don't think that's just the particular call center I work at. I've heard that from quite a few people I know working minimum wage jobs, that they've had to provide proof of graduation. Because I mean, I'm not really sure why, but yeah. So it'll be interesting to see how it affects employment rates now, because they are launching soon a new minimum income experiment in Ontario. Yeah. Sorry. which is based in the Hamilton area and the county that Hamilton is in, as well as in Thunder Bay. And that targets individuals and couples who are below the poverty line and seeks to bring them up to the poverty line.
Right. So it's about $16,000 that an individual would receive and $24,000 that a couple would receive.
Yeah, so it's not paid out as on an individual basis, which is interesting, but that's one of the points we had covered about minimum income. But basically how it works is that people who are eligible, from what I gather, is people who are below the poverty line, and there's a maximum amount, and then however much you make in a year diminishes what you'll get from the basic minimum income. So, for example, if you make $10,000 a year, you get half of your annual income taken off of the minimum amount that you would be receiving.
So, right,
they
so
would
you
receive.
Remove 5,000 from 16,000.
Yeah.
11,000.
Yeah. So it's proportional to based on need. That's the idea anyways. And that's, I think it's going to be about a 3-year experiment and they're going to see what happens.
Yeah, that's interesting. And, you know, as we mentioned, some candidates in the federal NDP race are talking about it. I know, you know, sometimes minimum is brought up by libertarians, counterintuitively, who advocate bringing in a minimum guaranteed income. But in order to bring in that, they would scrap all social services, which, I mean, I don't think that's very well advised.
No, and that's not what they're doing. The Ontario government has indicated that they're not going to be diminishing any welfare payments or healthcare payments or anything like that. And also for disabled participants, they can earn up to an extra $6,000. I don't know what that amount is based on and like how they would get the full $6,000 versus only $3,000, but they are making extra allotments for people who need more money because they cost more to keep healthy.
Right. Yeah, that makes sense. And people wonder how this gets paid for in the long run. As we mentioned, you know, people who have money can, you know, are generally in better health, and it takes a lesser toll on the healthcare system. Which is one of the greatest expenditures that every government has, or every provincial government has.
Mm-hmm.
So by cutting down on that, you can make every dollar go further.
Yeah, and I mean, apparently healthcare spending is very controversial among conservatives who, some of the further right people think that we should not be spending as much on public healthcare. So this would be a good way to take the burden off of the public healthcare system, I think.
Yeah. Cool. All right. So we're going to move on. Going back to another topic that we talked about on our last show, we did take a hiatus last week, but 2 weeks ago, we talked a little bit about May Day. And we were telling you about two events that were planned to happen in Winnipeg on May Day. And luckily, I went to both of them.
Also, disclaimer, I did not go to any of them. I was otherwise occupied with something. So I am reacting to this live on air. So
yes.
You're welcome.
Live retelling. So essentially, the two events that weren't exactly competing, but that happened, you know, one event joined the other. The first one was a Justice for Errol Green rally, organized in part by Revolutionary Student Movement and Bar None. So again, just a quick reminder, Errol Green was in custody a year ago at the Winnipeg Remand Center, was assaulted by prison guards and died in custody. That was on May 1st, 2016.
Mm-hmm.
So there was a rally held in front of the law courts, in solidarity with his family and to demand justice. I'm not sure what's happened to the guards in question. Yeah, so greater inquiry, things like that. It was not attended by members of the Winnipeg Labor Council, who were, organizing the other rally and who generally organize the May Day rally every year. The reason being that Winnipeg Labor Council also represents the union of prison guards.
Oh.
Uh-huh. So,
right.
Intrigue. So anyway.
Okay.
So anyway, the rally for Errol Green started at 4:30. The Winnipeg Labor Council march started at 5:30. So I got to things a little bit late. I got to the Errol Green rally just as it was wrapping up, and people were starting to march over to the Winnipeg Labor Council rally. Now, where controversy starts to happen, Revolutionary Student Movement was marching under the flags of the Soviet Union.
What?
Yeah.
Wait, what?
Yeah.
Okay.
And, you know, they're protesting police brutality and inhumane prison conditions.
And they're marching under the flags of this, like the Soviet Union?
Yeah, like hammer and sickle in top left corner in yellow on a red background. Like, straight up flag of the Soviet Union.
Okay.
Yeah, so...
If you can see my face right now.
Yeah, so me personally, I don't F with the USSR that much. So, yeah. I mean, I was looking for a little bit more of a radical tinge than what the Winnipeg Labor Council usually provides. They would tend to represent a bit more conservative labor in the city. But, I mean, USSR, though.
I don't think that's... I think that's a very bad idea. I do not... that does not sit well with me.
Yeah.
I don't think that... I don't think that Russia is an example that we really want to be going by in terms of how communism gets implemented in the future. And I don't think that marching under something that people viscerally despise so much is a very good idea if you're trying to make a stand for a specific cause that really, I mean...
Yeah.
Like, because they were still marching with the Errol Green rally, right?
Right, and sort of the Errol Green rally was supposed to go and then join the Winnipeg Labor Council march, which it did. You know, I just find it so ironic that, you know, May 1st is to commemorate the Haymarket Massacre, which is an instance of police brutality, and then you go and supposedly wanting to remember and act in that spirit and go march under the flag of USSR. Weird. Anyway... So the Errol Green rally happened at the law courts on Kennedy, and the Winnipeg Labor Council's march was slated to start at Memorial Park, so just a block away. So I marched over, did some chants and stuff, joined the crowd, handed out some leaflets, which were quite interesting, and actually I wish I'd brought it with me. But they were a bit provocative, but nothing in them was necessarily too out there. It criticized the NDP for being too lenient, for giving in to some populism under Gary Dewar, and then sort of not backing off from that enough under Selinger until the very end. Things about poverty reduction, things like that. And that was on one side. And then on the other side, it was saying that they don't support any marches with the support of police there.
Okay.
So, you know, that's reasonable. It was a bit inflammatory, but, you know, it was...
That's a real thing to talk about, though. Like,
yeah.
I think Pride Winnipeg is evaluating whether or not they want police at the march this year, at the parade this year. I think it was...
Toronto
police who said that they were... very offended by Pride Toronto's decision not to allow police officers to march with them. I think that's really ridiculous. I think that's really childish of the Toronto police to not understand where the gay community is coming from in not wanting police presence at a peaceful march of marginalized peoples who have a history of being assaulted by police officers.
Hashtag Stonewall.
Yeah.
Yeah.
For real.
Yeah. That the Toronto issue comes sort of was started off by demands made by Black Lives Matter Toronto at last year's Pride Parade. Anyway, that's a separate issue. So we're back at the Labor Council march.
Yes.
First speaker came up. I can't remember her name for the life of me. But she made a point of saying that, quote, we're here to represent all workers, including police and prison guards.
Okay.
So, I mean, were I in the position of the Winnipeg Labor Council, I just wouldn't have said anything, knowing that the RSM was there, knowing why, what they were up to. But anyway, they made a specific point about it, and so that incited some shouts from the crowd of F the police,
well,
etc. You know, pretty justified, I'd say. Mm-hmm. But anyway, that devolved into about a two-minute shouting match between the crowd and the speaker. Anyway, there were a bunch of different labor groups there. Amalgamated Transit Union was the largest represented. There were other left-wing groups there. NDP candidates, Wab Canoe was there.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway, so the march started relatively uneventfully. Marched down the usual parade route, up Memorial to Portage, Long Portage, then down Donald, Broadway, back to the ledge.
Mm-hmm.
The RSM radical contingent marched towards the back with their USSR flags flying high. Yeah. They eventually made it to the ledge. And I guess for some reason the Winnipeg Labor Council only planned to have one speaker mm-hmm. at the ledge, plus then a rendition of the Internationale, which was fun. But during the one speaker who didn't really touch on anything about police or anything, the RSM started a chant and started to completely disrupt the event,
mm-hmm.
Shouting Justice for Errol Green slogans and slogans against the prison guards. It's been a week and a half now. I don't remember what everything exactly yeah. was. But they generally just kind of tried to shut the whole thing down
okay.
from the back.
I mean, what's the point?
Right?
I do not want to diminish the Justice for Errol Green cause, because I think that is something that we need to fight harder for, and justice for our inmates. But the RSM seems often like it just wants to be inflammatory to me, and mm-hmm. it will do so by any means possible, by like raising a Soviet Union flag or by chanting something that, you know, it's not that march anymore. Like, you had that event ended and amalgamated into a larger May Day march that is organized by a group that you know represents unions. If you don't agree with that and you want to take a strong moral stance, then don't go.
Yeah. One thing that was interesting is that at the Justice for Errol Green march, they were joined by representatives from International Workers of the World, a.k.a. the Wobblies, mm-hmm. and the local anti-fascist organizers, Antifa. Basically, when the RSM started chanting and disrupting the speech at the ledge, representatives from all the other unions who bring their flags, as you do, to May Day protests, they all went up and stood behind the speaker who was being interrupted, and actually, the Wobblies and Antifa also walked up and stood behind the speaker. So I think they ended up losing more people than...
Yeah, it sounds like they messed up again.
Yeah.
And I won't say I'm surprised.
Yeah, I mean, like, I do see the need for a more radical contingent in the city, because they're admittedly, like, since the Winnipeg General Strike, which we'll be talking about next show, by
yes.
the way, Winnipeg Labor Council hasn't done that much of note radically, you know, and I think that it is important to have some radical element that continues to push and challenge you, but just like as long as you can just like coexist in the same space, you don't necessarily have to get along or agree on all the points. That's completely fair, and you know their ideological position is valid. Mm-hmm. Just like don't crap on everyone else all the time.
Yeah, you're not going to see me defending police unions or anything like that. But mm-hmm. you, in order to build a strong movement, you have to be welcoming to a vast majority of people. Like, you have to be welcoming to more central leftists in the hope that You can work together to build a left, like a real left, in our community, and then maybe a radicalization can happen with the more central people, because that's how it happens with most people, is that you start off somewhere in the middle, and then you hear ideas that are super radical, and you kind of agree with one side or the other, and then that's where you kind of go.
Mm-hmm.
I think that if you're only looking for radical people who already hold the same opinions as you, you're going to alienate the people who were already working with you before, who maybe didn't share all of those extreme opinions.
Mm-hmm. I mean, like, at the risk of sounding like liberals, but...
Yeah, at the risk of sounding like capital L's, like...
Not lowercase L liberals. I mean, like...
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, true enough. But, like... cooperation is the only way to get to a stronger movement, and I don't think that alienating people who mean well and who want to help is like a good idea.
Mm-hmm.
Ever, like, just in general.
Yeah, you know, I was marching for most of the time alongside Michael Barkman.
Uh-huh.
I think now former chairperson of Canadian Federation of Students Manitoba, which has attracted the ire of the revolutionary student movement across Canada, actually, just the Canadian Federation of Students in general, especially in Quebec. I think revolutionary student movement actually mm-hmm. managed to push out the Canadian Federation of Students altogether,
right.
Because the CFS is viewed as too moderate. And, you know, admittedly, like, the CFS hasn't done a whole lot, but what it has done is it's gotten a lot of students involved in student politics and student issues,
mm-hmm.
and some members of the RSM, who I won't name and whom I'm friends with, you know, they came up through the CFS and they had a lot of experience, you know, from working with the CFS.
Yeah, I mean, this is a thing that I see a lot with radicals, is that they start out in a certain place and then grow to a different place, and they once they've grown to a certain place, a lot of them seem to not be able to reflect back on how they used to be and then foster that kind of growth in other potential radical lefts.
Mm-hmm.
And it's sort of an empathetic lack, like it's a lack of sort of empathy and understanding of being hesitant to be really radical, because putting yourself out there like that is scary and people are afraid of things.
Yeah.
Should we move on from this incredible rant?
Yes, let's. So yeah. Once again, we'll be talking about the Winnipeg General Strike next week, because the anniversary of the start of the Winnipeg General Strike is May 17th, I believe.
15th.
15th.
Yeah.
Cool. Yeah. So big day on Tuesday in British Columbia. They had a big old provincial election, and for the first time in, I think it's 56 years, they've elected a minority government. Personally, I'm a big fan of minority governments.
Yeah.
I know people say that it's unstable, but it you know, it's really important, and I think it reflects how people voted and forces mm-hmm. compromise to some extent.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I'm always in favor of one viewpoint not having all of the control. That's
mm-hmm.
that's always something that I go for.
Yeah. So anyway, 44 seats were needed for a majority. The BC Liberals got 43. I think the NDP were at 41 and the Greens mm-hmm. at 3.
Wow.
So the Green Party holds the balance of power.
Mm-hmm.
So that means whomever they choose to side with will have the majority on any given bill
mm-hmm.
That's being debated. So that is a very powerful position.
Yeah.
For the Greens, even though it's just 3 and they're technically not an official party, it's big.
Yeah, that's crazy good for the Green Party.
Mm-hmm. Bit of a downgrade for Christy Clark and the BC Liberals. I think mm-hmm. they lost 7 seats since the dissolution. And NDP made some pretty significant gains. Interesting thing is that some of these results could be changing pretty drastically by the end of the month.
Mm.
A whole lot of recounts are going to they're going to have to have a whole bunch of recounts. There's one seat that was won by only 9 votes, but
Holy.
That has a disproportionate amount of absentee ballots, which are not counted until
right.
the end of the month. So that one will possibly flip from NDP to Liberal. So that's kind of exciting. Just a note on BC Liberals, they're not Liberals as you would think of it in the federal sense. They're an amalgamation of a former Conservative Party and a former Liberal Party that took most of the members of the Conservative Party and the name of the Liberal Party. So they're a bit more center-right than the other two parties. And speaking for BC, that you know, I guess they fall on the left end of the country, both geographically and politically.
Ooh.
Interesting.
Why we don't do comedy, yeah. Friends.
Interestingly enough, most of the BC Liberal seats were won on the Alberta border. So if that's any indication.
Sorry. It's okay. I'm fine. Of course that's an indication.
Yeah. So a couple issues that were discussed during the campaign, of course, top of mind is the BC housing situation, especially in Vancouver, where houses are just ridiculously unaffordable. And people in our generation living in Vancouver have no hopes ever of home ownership, effectively. So a couple plans were announced. The Liberals, you know, they've been in government for the last 16 years. And so this is their fifth mandate. And this is actually the first time that a female premier has been reelected in Canada. Interesting fun fact.
Well.
Yeah. So they've been in power, so they've had time to put in place their platform on this. So what they're not really promising anything new, but they want a 15% foreign buyers tax on purchases and a new program of interest-free loans up to $37,500 for first-time home buyers, and a commitment of about $1 billion overall toward building affordable rentals around the province, which housing groups say would mean $133 million a year for the next 3 years on top of what's already been committed. So they also want municipalities to cut down on wait times for building permits and stuff, specifics of which are vague. NDP wants to partner with cities and nonprofits, so unlike public-private partnerships, which happen a lot in this province, this would be partnering with nonprofits and with cities to create 11,400 new units of affordable housing for 10 years, which is the amount that the BC Nonprofit Housing Association says is needed. The NDP is also promising a $400 a year grant to renters to give them something equal to the homeowner grant and more protections for renters under the law. Including the removal of the current fixed-term lease provision. So that's pretty important because a lot of young people, home ownership is just not even a consideration. So it's going to be renting. So $400 a year. I don't know,
that's my monthly rent.
Yeah, that's not a whole lot.
That's nothing.
Yeah.
Like, it's a nice thought.
Green Party actually had the most aggressive approach. They were promising 30% foreign buyers tax that would apply to the whole province. And they would introduce a speculation tax plus a capital gains tax for sellers who flip properties in less than 5 years. Because that is a huge part of the problem that's driving up the price is foreign buyers are buying up relatively cheap properties, fixing them up, and then selling them for huge profit margins.
Right.
Yeah.
Thanks, HGTV. I'm kidding.
Taxes, Liberals, again, their budget was their main platform on that. The budget actually was tabled in February, but not passed into law yet. They want to bring in changes to medical service plan premiums, but otherwise, relatively little change. They want to actually freeze the carbon tax, which they've implemented, maintain the freeze actually until 2021, while other provinces catch up. So right now, I guess they have they have the highest carbon taxes, and the federal government has mandated that provinces either implement carbon tax or cap and trade. Mm-hmm. And so they're freezing theirs until 2021.
Okay.
However, they have admitted that that means that that will put them under their targets of emission reduction of 33% by the end of the decade. So.
Okay. And so, hold on. So they're freezing it because they want other provinces to catch up?
That's right. So, like, right now, their carbon tax is the highest in the country, and so mm-hmm. that's viewed as uncompetitive.
Okay.
So other provinces will have to be implementing carbon taxes in the next few years anyway.
Right.
So they're hoping that, you know, soon other provinces will be at the same level
okay.
that they're at. In terms of the environment, so the Liberals, they actually support the expansion of pipelines approved by Trudeau, the Kinder Morgan Trans Mountain Pipeline, as long as it meets their so-called five conditions, which I think are pretty lenient. And they also support constructing what's called the Site C dam. The NDP is against both of those, and the Green Party, of course, stands even more firmly against those.
Okay, well.
Pretty obvious.
Yeah.
You know, I don't know if that type of thing would come up in Parliament and the Green Party would have a chance to exercise their balance of power. That seems more like a cabinet decision.
Well, and I mean, we're not really going to know how the Green Party's balance of power plays in until the end of the month anyways.
That's right. Yeah,
so.
It could flop.
Yeah.
And anyway, the last thing we're going to talk about is cash for access, because that's been something that's been talked about on the federal level. In BC, there's very little regulation on donations and lobbyists.
Mm.
It's been a kind of Wild West situation, as they call it. And so the Liberals have, them having been in power for the last 16 years and having benefited from cash for access, which is basically, you know, paying an exorbitant fee to attend some event at which the premier or some cabinet minister will be present
mm-hmm.
in the hopes that you get a 10-minute conversation with them.
Yeah.
And, you know, shady dealings happen, allegedly. So the BC Liberals have been reluctant to bring anything in on that front, but now they are promising to impose caps. NDP has promised to ban corporate and union donations and review donation limits. Green Party, same deal. They would set the limits in line with federal rules, which caps individual donations at $1,550 a year. And they would also ban contributions from anyone living outside BC, which is currently not banned and seems kind of weird.
What?
Yeah.
I did not know that was the case. That's weird.
Yep. Well.
Well, yeah. I mean, I say weird, but I mean, interesting.
Yeah. Regulation and such.
In my best evil villain voice.
So, yeah, speaking of regulation and such, how's that for a segue?
Yes.
We're going to talk about the bill that was recently forced through in the federal House of Commons concerning parliamentary reform. Yeah, so one of the many things that's brought in by this new Liberal bill is a change to the way question period happens. And this was something that Prime Minister Trudeau had talked about earlier on in his mandate. He wants to bring in something that's kind of similar to the British system, where the Prime Minister has a dedicated day for questions in which all of the questions in question period would be directed towards the Prime Minister. You know, Trudeau has been sort of admonished for his
he doesn't answer any questions.
Well, yeah,
he never answers any questions.
Not only does he not answer the questions, he's very frequently not in the House, and he doesn't debate as much. He's known for loving campaigning and not so much liking the actual governing bit.
So then, like, why is he implementing this if he doesn't even want to be there?
Well, it's so that he only has to be there one day a week, I guess.
Oh my God.
Right? And
so
then
you can go one day a week and just like not answer anyone's questions.
Yeah, that's
awesome. Great.
That's basically the criticisms from the other parties, NDP and conservatives have been making quite a fuss about it, but I think the bill passed in the end. So it's interesting to contrast this, where the Liberals have used their majority to force through a bill and not require consensus from the House.
Mm-hmm.
When you know, last time we talked about electoral reform that supposedly required some enormous national consensus.
Yeah, I mean, I said it last week and I will say it again. Liberals, like capital L Liberals, like to tout the idea when it's convenient for them that they want to do what everyone wants.
Yeah.
But when it's not convenient for them, they just go and they pass things as quickly as possible and push them through governing bodies because they can, because they're in the majority government. So
yeah, you know, they promised when they came in a great departure from the Harper era, and I think in the first couple of months of their mandate, they certainly delivered on that to some extent in terms of optics. You know, they increased the accessibility of the Prime Minister to media and things like that, but it's not back to the way it was before Harper. In that particular respect. And, you know, broken promises about electoral reform and many, many others. They're fulfilling the liberal stereotype of campaigning from the left and governing from the right.
Yeah, absolutely. And this is like the garbage policy that we should be criticizing Trudeau on.
Yeah.
This is like the stuff that we should be mad about, because governing this way is not in the best interest of all of us. I mean, under-debated bills don't really do anyone any good.
Yeah. Okay, and we're going to wrap up the show with two different tales of two different people getting fired in two very different circumstances. So the first one, I know our mandate is mostly to talk about Canadian politics, but when some big things happen in the U.S., you know, it's inevitable. We're going to talk about them. Big news this week, Trump fired FBI Director James Comey. Big surprise.
Yeah, wow.
So a bit of context here. Trump's letter supposedly states that he's being fired over the handling of the Hillary Clinton email scandal during the campaign. This makes about zero sense total.
Well, as with, like, literally everything Donald Trump has ever done in his life.
Right. I mean, but, like, putting all that aside, you know, if you go back to the campaign, initially Trump was praising Comey for having brought up the Hillary issue a couple days before the election. Him and James Mattis, Jeff Sessions. Jeff Sessions, the Attorney General. Mm. They were both praising James Comey because he announced to the public that they were reopening an investigation into Hillary Clinton's emails. Turned out to be completely harmless, nothing at all. But apparently that had an effect on the election when it came to election day, Anyway, so that was that. However, once the Russia involvement scandal, Russia's involvement in the election, the scandal surrounding that started to break, Trump's attitude towards Comey started to sour a little bit. Basically, we're of course talking about the allegations of Russian hacking into mm-hmm. the DNC and leaking of information to WikiLeaks and such. As well as collusion between senior Russian officials and members of the Trump campaign and Trump administration. Some more obvious signs of that is the Michael Flynn debacle, where he'd received money from the Russian government, had been warned to disclose that, did not disclose it, lied about it to the vice president, got fired. So there's a whole investigation going on about it, and Jeff Sessions, the attorney general, who normally looks after matters of the FBI, had to recuse himself because of his involvement in the Trump campaign, and so he could basically find himself under investigation. So obviously he has to step back so that he doesn't get too involved.
Mm-hmm.
So anyway, apparently New York Times and Washington Post on Tuesday broke that a couple days ago, James Comey asked for an increase in funding for the Russia investigation. There were also some interesting hearings in front of Congress. James Comey spoke. The former temporary acting attorney general spoke, and it seems that there was quite a big web net. And anyway, so on Monday, during the day, while James Comey was at a recruiting event in Los Angeles, news broke that the Trump administration had fired Comey.
Mm-hmm.
And Comey found out while watching TV in a local FBI station.
That's amazing.
Yeah. I mean, it's kind of hard to feel sad for James Comey. Like, he like, seriously screwed things up for Clinton. I mean, she did a lot of that to herself. But it's pretty obvious that his actions leading up to the election did have some effect. Nevertheless, this is some pretty shady garbage going on.
Yeah, I mean, it sounds really shady. I don't necessarily think that James Comey is the reason Hillary Clinton lost.
Oh, definitely not.
I have a lot of opinions about that, but this is not an American politics show, so we're not going to talk about that. I don't know. I know. I rarely feel sorry for people in high bureaucratic positions when they get fired for messing stuff up. So.
Yeah, I know, but like, yeah, he messed it up.
Yeah.
But Trump had, like, what, 3 months to fire him over that?
Yeah, I mean, well, yeah, but I mean, Donald Trump is not a rational person. Donald Trump is a person who is swayed by what he sees on TV and, like, watches TV, and that's his reality. Like, you know, like...
Yeah, I think, right? I think what the issue that people are raising now is that the timing is weird. Like, the FBI is sort of closing in on the Russia issue.
Mm-hmm.
And so this was an attempt to Nixonianly disrupt the investigation.
Oh, yeah. I mean, absolutely. I don't think that's really even super speculative at this point. But, yeah, I don't know. I also don't super know what I'm talking about here, because I have taken a self-imposed break from American politics because it was stressing me out a lot. So Anatole knows a lot more about this than I do.
Yeah.
So, I mean, suspicious, yes. I don't really feel bad for him, but it is suspicious.
Yeah. We'll have to see what comes out of this.
Mm-hmm.
and who Trump appoints to replace James Comey.
Yeah.
I mean, like, anyone that he appoints is definitely going to be under some suspicion of being a lackey.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
Yeah.
That'll be... We'll see.
Yeah. So, the other person who got fired, or rather resigned before they could get fired, back to Canada, and this is under various dubious circumstances, is Senator Don Meredith. So this was the senator who was accused of having an inappropriate sexual relationship with a 16-year-old and continued until she was 18.
And she was a staffer, right?
She was a staffer, yeah.
So she was under his employ?
Yes.
Well,
and used his position of power to lure and, continue the relationship. Pretty gross.
He should have been immediately fired, and I'm really, really mad that he hasn't been. Like in any other job, that's exactly what would have happened.
Yeah. Basically, what happened was he claimed that they were not romantically involved until she turned 18. Then there was an ethics review board investigation. They found that was absolutely not the case, and that they recommended that a vote happen for him to to be expelled from the Senate, mm-hmm. At which point he would have a chance to defend himself in the chamber, and then a vote would happen as to whether or not he would get expelled. But he resigned before the vote could happen. So the aftermath of that is that he gets to keep his senator's pension.
I think that processes like that are in place for exactly this reason, and I think that he took advantage of the system that was laid out for him. I'm not even gonna be remotely forgiving about this, because I think that that is a reprehensible thing for him to have done. So any crap minimum wage job you have, if there are managers, they make a point of talking about what happens when there are power imbalances in relationships if you are dating someone within the company. That's something that, we had a thing at Walmart when I got trained at Walmart about, managerial and, cashier relationships and all that. It's highly, highly inappropriate for him to be using a position of power to basically woo and coerce a girl into this relationship. And that's inappropriate. That should result in immediate termination. And I don't think that he should get a suspension at the very least. I think that should the girl press charges, that they should, be found. I would call for him to go to jail for that.
Yeah.
It's disgusting.
Definitely. And the Senate of late has been great at really disgracing itself. I mean, you've got senators like Patrick Brazeau, who is, multiple allegations of domestic abuse, drug charges, runs a strip club, and he's still a senator and has somehow been cleared of all his charges. You've got the senator expense scandal that supposedly all these incredibly smart people couldn't understand what they can and what they can't claim as expenses. And then you've got just ridiculously privileged idiots who complain about ice cold camembert on Air Canada flights. Is the Senate even relevant today?
I don't know enough about the processes of the Senate to comment on that at the moment, but I'm sure I will read a lot and have an informed opinion by a later date. That's something we should probably talk about, though.
Yeah. I mean, so much for sober second thought.
Yeah.
Huh. Uh-huh. Actually, the Senate put out their own, little children's book pretty recently.
Wait, what?
Yeah, no, I'm not shitting you.
I did not hear about this.
Yeah, it's called The Wise Owls or something to that
effect.
Oh,
my God.
Yeah. So all the animals in the forest have sort of their little parliament, and
it's like an animal caste system.
Not quite. Basically there was beavers ask if they can chop down some trees to build their dams, and so the animal parliament goes ahead and says, yes, by all means, you may do so that you can build your dwelling. But then the squirrels start complaining that, oh God, these are our homes being destroyed. And the wise owls have being perched atop the trees, and they see everything, inform the parliament that, no, this is a terrible idea. You should reconsider. And so that's the point of the Senate. Sober second thought.
I have developed a facial tic from hearing that story.
Yeah.
I rolled my eyes so hard that now my eyes are blinking really quickly, and I'm just I can't.
Yeah, I think that the Senate has really discredited itself of late, and it's time for some serious reform beyond what Trudeau has done, where it's just effectively kicking all the senators out of the party and giving them a bit more independence. I don't think that's necessarily a good thing, seeing as these are just randomly appointed people.
And how long do senators usually stay?
Until age 75.
That's insane.
Yep.
That's ridiculous. I don't feel like a 75-year-old knows enough about what's going on in the lives of most people, especially when you're at that high wealth bracket and you're so rich that you're complaining about drinks on flights. Mm-hmm. if you're complaining about that, I don't feel like you understand like the everyday Canadian well enough to be making serious decisions on our behalf.
Yeah. I mean, like, some good things that the Senate does is that they hold, you know, they do investigations and they hold panels of mm-hmm. experts to comment on bills and things. And, you know, that's a good thing, and it saves time from the House. But the fact that they can amend bills and, frankly, stop them or, you know, reimpose some draconian ones is pretty unfortunate.
And that they hold power for so long.
Yeah.
Like, that's, like, people in power should not just get a pass like that.
Mm-hmm. And they're accountable only to themselves.
Well, yeah, exactly. Like, they're not accountable to us when they're passing bills or blocking bills that affect, I mean, us and our livelihoods and situations. Like, that's... people in power should always be afraid.
Mm-hmm.
I heard that somewhere. I can't remember who said it, but it's been floating around a lot on social media, and I stand by it.
Yeah, that's good.
Yeah. They should always be afraid of losing power because they should be held accountable to the people who got them there. But the person who gets the senators there, they're appointed, right? So are they appointed or elected?
Senators are appointed. It's usually on recommendation of the prime minister.
Yeah, but I mean, still, like, the accountability to the majority of Canadians is very, very slim there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and then when a senator does something wrong, whether or not they should be expelled is discussed within the Senate. And then part of the discussion is whether or not the expulsion of the senator would attract more or less controversy than allowing the senator to remain. So the discussion is less about the act as opposed to the image of the Senate in the eyes of Canadians.
Yeah, and also the discussion apparently takes so long that you can just resign if you're going to get expelled.
Yeah, exactly. Like, had he waited two more days, they would have expelled him and he wouldn't have his pension, you know. But
obviously, if they're having a hearing and it's been at the recommendation of an ethics committee that you should be expelled, like, that's not, like, he shouldn't have a chance to defend himself. He shouldn't have that 2-day period where he could resign if he wanted to, because even if you don't think you're going to get expelled, the chance of your comfy senator pension over nothing is an obvious one to that kind of person, I think.
Yeah, like, definitely. And, like, yes, you should have the chance to defend yourself, but he had the chance to defend himself in the ethics review, you know, and, like, present his side of the story.
Well, and, like, why wouldn't they hold the vote and then present the findings of the ethics committee as, like, before they're voting for the consideration of the Senate, right? Like, why would they publicize the ethics committee's findings so long before they take the actual vote?
It's just how long things take in Ottawa.
Well, it takes too long.
Yeah.
I'm mad. I was recently told that I seem like I'm always angry, so I guess I'm living up to my reputation now.
That's good. That's a good characteristic.
You're the only person who said that, so thank you.
You're very welcome. All right, I think that's us for today. So join us next week. We're going to be talking about the Winnipeg General Strike and its repercussions on history. Some updates for the Conservative federal leadership race. Convention is coming up in 2 weeks, I believe. And the NDP race, rumor mill is abuzz. Apparently, Jagmeet Singh, Ontario MLA, is going to be throwing his hat in the race. So we'll have a lot to talk about there. Maybe revisit some more fine-tuned policy points and see where we go from there.
Yeah, all right. So thanks for tuning in, and we'll see y'all next week.
I'm Anatole.
And I'm Katie.
Thanks for listening to the Politics Hour.